Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for The Future Investor, Data-Powered Transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative, investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/futureinvestor/radio.
This is Bloomberg Law with June Grosso from Bloomberg Radio.
The Supreme Court decided unanimously in favor of Donald Trump, ruling that Colorado can't kick him off the presidential ballot and putting an end to efforts across the country to ban Trump under Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, a rarely used constitutional provision barring insurrectionists from holding office. Trump thanked the Supreme Court.
And they worked long, they worked hard, and frankly, they worked very quickly on something that will be spoken about 100 years from now and 200 years from now, extremely important. Essentially, you cannot take somebody out of a race because an opponent would like to have it that way.
Contrary to Trump's interpretation, what the court actually ruled was that a state can't bar a candidate for federal office on the grounds that that person is an insurrectionist. It's Congress who has the exclusive power to enforce Section 3. The unsigned opinion mirrors the concerns expressed by the justices during oral arguments about a state-by-state determination of disqualifications. Here's Justice Elena Kagan.
I think that the question that you have to confront is why a single state should decide who gets to be president of the United States. In other words, you know, this question of whether a former president is disqualified for insurrection to be president again is, you know, just say it. It sounds awfully national.
Joining me is elections law expert Richard Brofault, a professor at Columbia Law School. Rich, I don't think anyone was surprised that the court left Trump on the ballot. What was the reasoning they used to make their decision?
There's only one thing the court clearly decided, is that the states cannot enforce Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, the exclusion of insurrectionists from office, with respect to federal offices. States can enforce it with respect to state offices, but not with respect to federal offices. To do that, they would need some authorization from Congress, and they didn't have it here. That's what's clear, and that's what all nine of the justices agreed to. And the why is probably somewhere along the lines of a concern that when you're dealing with national offices and states, different states will come to different rulings and even will have different ways of going about their rulings, different standards for what counts as an insurrection or who counts as an insurrectionist. So they'll get to different results even when they're dealing with the same position. And you can't have that kind of a patchwork for some national office like president. After that, it's not quite clear what the court decided. Or I guess there were five justices on the main part of the opinion. And then three, and depending on how you count them, three or four disagreed. Wasn't quite clear what the disagreement is about. Probably what happens is the majority started talking about how Congress, what kind of law Congress would have to pass if Congress were to provide for the exclusion of insurrectionists. And basically making the point that it would have to use another section of the 14th Amendment, Section 5, which has a certain provision allowing for congressional enforcement, and that would have to look a certain way based on prior Supreme Court cases which talk about what congressional remedial and enforcement legislation has to look like when it gets passed under Section 5 of the 14th Amendment. That's where the majority went, and that's where the three, they label themselves concurrences, but they look like they were dissents. That's where they said, no, you shouldn't have done that, that you're going too far, you shouldn't be resolving that, you should have just stuck to the early part. And sort of Justice Barrett buys part of it, what the majority did, but doesn't buy the other part. It's not quite clear what she saw was the difference between the two parts of the majority that the three more liberal justices all disagree with.
Since there were five votes for the proposition that the 14th Amendment can only be enforced by passing legislation, and you talked about the what they said the legislation should include, does that mean that's now Supreme Court precedent, or could it be considered dicta or not legally binding?
Well, you know, people always argue about what's dicta and what's precedent. You don't really know what's dicta and what's precedent until the next case comes along. But it is probably closer to precedent. They were relying, a significant degree on an individual opinion by a justice of the Supreme Court who was sitting as an individual judge back in 1869, Chief Justice Salmon Chase. And in a particular individual case, he basically said Congress needs to pass a statute. The Supreme Court as a whole had never said that before. And what the majority appears to be embracing is that position, that you need to have some kind of statute from Congress, maybe laying out the procedure for declaring somebody to be an insurrectionist, maybe declaring what constitutes insurrection, but they're not even that clear. But I do think they're basically taking the position that a statute by Congress authorizing an exclusion from office would have to have, you know, be, as they say, congruent and proportional to the language in the Constitution.
Once again, very clear what Congress might have to do. So you mentioned the three liberals who were in concurrence.
Right.
And I said sharp, but you said more like a dissent, and said the majority went further than it needed to. Quote, they decide novel constitutional questions to insulate this court and petitioner from future controversy. What did they mean by that?
That's a good question. I think they said the court has basically taken itself out of anything having to do with the insurrection question with respect to this election. And I'm not quite sure what they meant by that. I'm not quite sure what kinds of issues would come up as to what the court resolved in a way that would have an immediate impact. Handedly, I find both the majority opinion and the concurrence really kind of murky as to what they're arguing about.
And interesting, in their first line, they quoted from the Dobbs decision, which took away the constitutional right to abortion. I found that sort of curious. Now, Justice Amy Coney Barrett, in her separate, more temperate concurrence, wrote, "The court has settled a politically charged issue in the volatile season of a presidential election. Particularly in this circumstance, writings on the court should turn the national temperature down, not up." Is this sort of in line with her recent appearance with Justice Sonia Sotomayor, where they talked about how well everyone on the court gets along and how they're not beholden to the presidents who appointed them? I mean,
right.
Is she trying this sort of let's be calm about this?
Yes, I think there's a certain wouldn't it be nice aspect to it. Yeah, let's be calm. Let's kind of model civil behavior in a very polarized country. And not only anyone would argue with that in principle, what's actually unclear is like, she joined some of the court's opinion and not other parts, but the parts that she joined and the parts she didn't join seemed to be related. So it was not quite clear. And as she says, she joined 2B, but not 2A. It wasn't quite clear to me what the difference is between 2A and 2B, and she doesn't explain that. So I don't know. She is in agreement, I think, with the concurring justices, who there's some evidence that might have started out as a dissenting opinion. Her opening sentence is, "I agree that states lack the power to enforce Section 3 against presidential candidates." That's a very good summary of what you might call the core holding of the court that everybody agrees with. All nine agree with that. I think where the disagreement begins to come in is what happens with respect to other kinds of action. States can't do it without a law. Can the federal government do something without a law? What should the law look like? And those are the questions.
I'm wondering this, and this was something that the lawyer for the Colorado voters said in oral arguments, that a ruling requiring congressional action to implement Section 3 could leave the door open to a renewed fight over trying to use the provision to disqualify Trump in the event he wins the election.
Right. There's a raging debate, even in the hours since this case came down, as to whether or not Congress could reject votes for Trump on the theory that he is an insurrectionist. Some people read the majority opinion as saying, no, they couldn't do it unless they passed a law first. Other people, I think, are probably right, saying, no, Congress would be acting not under its 14th Amendment power, but under its power under other parts of the Constitution, including the 12th Amendment, to actually count the electoral votes and determine whether they were properly given for an eligible candidate. So people are already disagreeing as to whether or not this would prohibit, in the unlikely event that you actually get two houses of Congress to agree to this, to not count the votes for Trump on the theory that he's an insurrectionist. One theory is that, no, the Supreme Court said you can't do it unless you've already passed a statute. Another theory, and I would go with the second theory, is that, no, Congress has separate authority when it counts the electoral votes to decide whether or not the electoral votes were properly given for an eligible candidate. And if the Congress decides that these votes are for somebody ineligible, they're exercising a different power.
Do you think that's what the three liberals in their concurrence/dissent were concerned about?
this might be what they're arguing about. It's really not clear, but this might be what they're arguing about as to whether or not, did the majority rule that out? You know, frankly, it could come up in other ways. I mean, what happens if this came up as a state-level dispute? What if somebody were to sue in federal court? I think the majority is saying that if somebody sues in federal court to keep Trump off the ballot, you still need a statute, even though it would be a federal actor, a federal judge making the decision. But what they don't address, let alone resolve, as to whether or not when Congress acts pursuant to its authority to count the electoral votes and declare a winner, whether they are bound by this idea that they need to pass a law first to discuss that, to review the question of insurrection. The second point some people have raised is, well, Congress actually did pass an Electoral Count Reform Act last year. Is that a good enough law? Would that law take care of this? Because it has procedures for challenging electoral votes. And finally, is Congress acting under a different power when Congress resolves issues about who's eligible for president when the electoral votes are presented? Similarly, if an issue came before Congress about one of their own, an arguable insurrectionist was elected to, say, the House of Representatives, could the House of Representatives decide to not seat that person on the theory that the person isn't eligible? You know, the House traditionally has authority to determine whether or not somebody satisfies the qualifications to be a member of the House, although they can't add any. So I think it might be a question that would also come up then.
And there was no discussion at all about Trump being an insurrectionist or not.
That's right. They did not address that. They did not address whether he had a free speech defense. They didn't address the interesting question of whether or not the president is an officer of the United States. I mean, there's a theory out there that in a technical sense, the president is not covered by this provision of the Constitution, although members of Congress would be. So they don't address that either.
This is the court's most direct involvement in a presidential election since Bush v. Gore, would you say?
Well, there are a bunch of cases that came before the court in 2020. They sidestepped a lot of them. So this is maybe the first full opinion. But there were some actually opinions that dealt with voter eligibility, absentee ballots and things like that in the 2020 election. But certainly it's the first one to directly address a candidate.
And next month they'll be addressing whether that candidate has presidential immunity from prosecution. Thanks so much, Rich. That's Professor Richard Brafault of Columbia Law School. Coming up next, are sanctuary cities getting a bad rap? I'm June Grosso, and you're listening to Bloomberg.
Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for The Future Investor, Data-Powered Transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/futureinvestor/radio.
New York City Mayor Eric Adams wants its sanctuary city laws to be changed to more easily deport migrants accused of violent crimes.
But those small numbers that are committing crimes, we need to modify the sanctuary city law that if you commit a felony, a violent act, we should be able to turn you over to ICE and have you deported. It is a right to live in this city, and you should be not committing crimes in our city but doing so. Right now, we don't have the authority to do so.
The mayor said his administration is looking into legal options after the city council refused to reevaluate the sanctuary city laws. Joining me is Leon Fresco, a partner at Holland & Knight and former head of the Office of Immigration Litigation in the Obama administration. So, Leon, how does what the mayor wants to do conflict with New York City's sanctuary laws?
Well, so this is a very complicated issue, and I'll give you a brief history of how it started and sort of where it's morphed to, because it's not clear where Mayor Adams wants to draw the line. But the reason this whole concept of sanctuary city started is that during the Bush administration, many places around the country had practices where if any local police officer encountered anyone that they thought might be in illegal status, they would immediately call ICE. And so this was happening for things like traffic stops or people just running into police in a concert or something or wherever. It was happening all over the place. And police were simply just calling ICE and sending people to ICE custody. And this was creating lots of sort of fear and commotion and buzz in a lot of big cities across America because people were worried. If I even go outside of my house, if I go to work, if I go on a bus, I will be apprehended by ICE. So the sanctuary city movement started under the principle of what you want to capture are actual criminals. You don't want to capture undocumented people who are having interactions with police. You want to capture people convicted of criminal offenses. So what many states and cities started doing, first some cities, then some entire states, they started first with the concept of don't report anyone to ICE unless and until they're actually charged. So there was one step. First of all, maybe not arrested, but at least charged. Then there was a second step, not charged, but convicted. And then there was a third step, not just convicted, but convicted of a violent crime. And so that's where a lot of these states and cities are now, is they will not report you to ICE unless you actually have a conviction and if it's of a violent crime. But what has happened in the meantime? In the meantime, over the course of, we're talking from the Bush administration, 2007, to now, 15 years, but mostly in the last 5 or 6 years, now a typical interaction with police isn't going to lead to anything, basically, in a lot of these big cities. But even more difficult to grapple with is even in legitimate crimes, they won't lead to prosecutions. And then even in violent crime situations, they won't lead to prosecutions. And so there's now not a way to actually notify ICE that you have come encountered with a violent criminal, because these new criminal processing guidelines that a lot of these district attorneys have put in, including the district attorney in New York, have basically made it impossible that when the police interacts with an actual violent criminal, if there's no prosecution that actually leads to a conviction for a violent crime, there will never be an interaction with ICE where ICE actually detains the person and deports them. And so that's the problem we're seeing is.
So it's a two-part problem, not only the sanctuary city laws, but also the way the Manhattan DA, Alvin Bragg, is enforcing or not enforcing the criminal laws.
That's why I think Mayor Adams, he's got to make a choice. Is he saying that every time the police interacts with someone, they're going to call ICE? Or is he going to put pressure on the district attorney to actually prosecute people and actually convict people for the crimes that they are committing? Those are the only two ways to solve the problem. If you don't do it the second way, where the district attorney is actually prosecuting and convicting people for the actual crimes they're committing, then it's harder to have this sanctuary city policy where you're saying, look, we don't want ICE being called every single time the police interact with somebody, because that's the only time you'll be able to call them. There won't be a time of a conviction. And so that's what creates the problem.
And then you have a situation where the migrants who attacked the police officers, and we see videos of them exiting the police station, you know, giving a finger to the camera.
Correct.
And people are like, why is that happening? So it's first a problem with the district attorney, right, not asking for bail.
Correct. The district attorney needs to keep people in detention and then convict them of the actual crimes they're committing. And then you don't need to get rid of sanctuary cities, because people who actually do the kinds of acts that are being offensive to people will then eventually get called to ICE. But if the district attorney doesn't actually prosecute people and keep them in detention, then the mayor only has one choice, which is to end the sanctuary city doctrine, which means just when the police interact with someone, regardless of whether they're going to be guilty or not, they just call ICE. And so that's the question. You only have those two alternatives, but when you've taken away both alternatives, that's where you end up with the current situation of today.
And any changes in New York City sanctuary policy would require the city council's cooperation, and the city council has already said no. So
correct. And so it's a big problem. But I think very few people are explaining the problem in this manner, and they're thinking it's a purely sanctuary city issue, and people aren't understanding that it's not so much the sanctuary city issue, it's how it's interacting with the new manner in which prosecutors are actually treating people who commit crimes. That's the real problem. But if you're not going to fix that, then yes, you have to roll back some of these sanctuary city protections.
Now, Georgia's House has passed a new law in light of the murder of nursing student Laken Riley and the arrest of an illegal Venezuelan migrant for the murder. A migrant who, by the way, had been arrested and released by New York City police in August of last year. Tell us about that law.
Well, a lot of these states are starting to create these laws that are deputizing people, whether they be local law enforcement or whether they be actual police. And this one is being named after the poor young woman, Laken Riley, who was at the University of Georgia, who was unfortunately murdered by one of these undocumented people who had passed through New York. What they're basically saying is if Homeland Security does not deport someone who ends up committing a crime, the state attorney general would be allowed to sue, and it would require the police to help arrest undocumented immigrants if they're called by anybody. So they're saying, you know, anybody could become sort of a private deputy type person and call the police, and then the police would have to go find the person and report them to ICE. The problem with these issues is, I mean, one, it has to pass, but even if it were to pass, the law allows these sort of arrangements where local law enforcement could be deputized by ICE to perform some functions, and also where they can actually detain for a brief period and call ICE for reasonable suspicion. But there's two issues. Number one, with the current administration, you have to ask the question, if you call ICE, will ICE answer the phone? Will it even, you know, will it take your call? Will it then come and visit the person? And if they don't, it doesn't matter how many times you call them. So that's one problem. And then the second problem, and I think that's what they're trying to solve with these lawsuits, but the second problem is if you sue the federal government for not basically enforcing immigration law, Texas already tried that, and there's a Supreme Court case from just 2 years ago saying the states cannot dictate how the federal government enforces immigration law. So this has already been tried. This has already worked its way all the way up to these specific nine judges, and these specific nine judges have said that states can't be imposing their will on the federal government with regard to who to deport, who to detain, et cetera.
Which case was that, Leon?
That was the Biden versus Texas prosecutorial discretion guidelines case, where the Secretary of Homeland Security, Alejandro Mayorkas, had made a memo saying, here are the people we're going to be emphasizing and here are the people we're going to be de-emphasizing. And Texas sued, and there was a district court judge who said, absolutely, you're right, Texas, they can't do this. And basically this judge was deciding who ICE could deport or not deport, and the Supreme Court said this is not tenable. This is not a thing that we can continue. This has to be left to the federal government and the agency that does this, the Department of Homeland Security. And so they just said the states don't have standing to get involved or complain using any sort of statute or judicial authority about the manner in which the federal government enforces immigration law.
Coming up next on the Bloomberg Law Show, while Donald Trump was thanking the Supreme Court for ruling in his favor today, he also challenged Joe Biden to close the border. That's coming up next. I'm June Grosso, and you're listening to Bloomberg.
Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for The Future Investor, Data-Powered Transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative, investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/futureinvestor/radio.
The other thing I say to President Biden, close the borders now.
After thanking the Supreme Court for ruling in his favor and preventing states from kicking him off ballots, Donald Trump veered into the topics of presidential immunity, the success of his presidency, the unfairness of the trials facing him, and the border, telling President Biden to close the border, just as he had done.
You have to stop. You have to close the border. You have absolute authorization. You don't need Congress. I had the safest border in the history of our country, and I didn't use Congress for it.
I've been talking to immigration law expert Leon Fresco of Holland & Knight. Leon, can Biden just close the border?
Well, so there are a couple of points here, and it really matters what time frame you're looking at and what do you mean, because on the day of the transition between Trump and Biden, the border, quote unquote, was closed, but that was because of Title 42 and the COVID pandemic. There was a federal national emergency which required the federal government under Title 42 to close the border. Now, if President Biden were to issue a Title 42 emergency, he'd be sued because they'd say, what emergency? What pandemic? So that sort of statement doesn't tell you much because it's a deceptive statement. But if you're not talking about Title 42 authority and you're talking about what other things Trump did, well, the only other main thing that he did that started to build some traction, although it was not even remotely a closed border, was the issue of Remain in Mexico. But there, that was a long process where Trump first needed to threaten Mexico with tariffs on cars and then build up infrastructure in Mexico. And that wasn't even done yet by the time COVID came. COVID came and just made it easier to do Title 42. Where Trump is criticizing Biden is that he shouldn't have reversed Remain in Mexico. But whether that criticism is valid or not, it's been done already. So he couldn't just re-turn on the button right this minute. He'd have to do some similar threat because now, in the meantime, the Mexican Supreme Court has said that Mexico can no longer permit a Remain in Mexico type arrangement, that that's not constitutional under Mexican law. So President Biden would have to engage in very similar, very hostile threats toward Mexico that would get them to change their constitution to allow this. But, you know, I'm not saying that couldn't happen, and I'm not saying Trump wouldn't do it. All I'm saying is that's the kind of thing that would need to happen. And then you'd need to rebuild all that infrastructure, which would have no chance of happening before November. And so that's the difficult question. That's why President Biden was so focused and leaning on this congressional legislation, which would have recreated the Title 42 exclusion authority, where you could just literally kick people out, but you would be kicking people out without needing a pandemic to do it. You would be kicking them out sort of with a high volume of people as your justification rather than a pandemic.
Leon, we talked about the rumors that President Biden was going to put in place some executive actions.
Correct.
About the border. What happened to that?
I think there's a couple of problems. Number one, I think he's waiting for 2, 3, 4 weeks from now, once all the sort of government budgeting and shutdowns and delays and all of that are solved, because I think right now doing something within that framework ends up complicating issues. Once you get the government funded for the year, then you might decide, okay, now I have these sources of funding that I didn't have, that I could maybe divert toward this new regulation that I'm doing or this new executive order if I'm going to have more detention space or if I'm going to do something else. And so I think that's why you're not seeing it. I think he's hoping to get the government funding issue resolved beforehand. But I also think he's probably being told there's very little he can do other than remain in Mexico to try to resolve this, and that remain in Mexico is going to take a very long time. Basically, Trump went through the same iterations for 3 years. He tried every single thing that they told him to try, and every single thing got blocked by the court. And so what ended up happening is the only thing he could do was remain in Mexico. I think this is the advice that's being given to President Biden, And he's saying, well, I just spent a year calling that thing terrible. It can't be done. It's a big human rights violation, et cetera. I don't know if I can come back to doing that now. And I think that's the problem.
Let's turn now to Texas, which has been suing the federal government for years and has spent $1.4 million litigating cases related to the border and immigration since Biden took office. I want to get straight some of the legal fights that Texas has.
So the ones that they currently have, the biggest one, which is literally relevant as of today, is that the Fifth Circuit overturned the judge in Austin who overturned the Texas state law, which was allowing Texas to basically deport undocumented people. So there was the law Texas recently passed that said, look, we can push people across the border, our Texas state people. And if people come back in, that's going to be a Texas felony of trespassing. And the court in Austin, the district judge, said that's illegal. That violates the Arizona law case from 2012 that John Roberts decided and Justice Kennedy. And this argument that Texas was making, well, Arizona doesn't apply because this is an actual invasion, whereas the Arizona wasn't facing an invasion. This is an invasion. And the president isn't guarding Texas during an invasion. And the judge said, look, this is not a proper application of that invasion clause. This is just an immigration issue. This is not, people aren't coming across actually trying to overthrow the government of the United States. And so from that standpoint, that was enjoined. Just this weekend, although the order came out today, but it was during the weekend, the Fifth Circuit has stayed that order for the next 7 days, meaning Texas's law is legal again for the next 7 days. And then the question is, does the federal government now go to the Supreme Court to try to enjoin the law again, or do they try to fight it out in the Fifth Circuit? So they will have both of those choices. It is unclear what the federal government will do. I actually don't know as I sit here. Maybe they would just want to go straight to the Supreme Court. But again, this is unclear.
That happens so fast. There was no argument, was there, at the Fifth Circuit?
No, it was just a seven-day stay that says, look, you've got 7 days, go to the Supreme Court if you want. You can skip us entirely. And so now the federal government doesn't have to skip the Fifth Circuit entirely, but they can if they want to. And so if the federal government wants to skip the Fifth Circuit, they can. And now because the Fifth Circuit has actually ruled, they stayed the injunction, meaning the Texas law is legal. And so if they want to make the Texas law illegal again, they would go to the Supreme Court and then there'd be arguments about that. So it'll be very interesting to see if that's what the federal government does. And if it does that, remember, the Supreme Court already has many, many, many cases they're trying to get done before the end of June. And to add this extra one will be very interesting to see if they want to add it or not, or do they just want to let the Fifth Circuit work this out on their own and come back to it later. And so we'll see.
I was going to ask you how the Biden administration actually found a judge in Texas who ruled in their favor, because it's usually the case that the district court judges do.
The way these Texas divisions are on the Southern District of Texas, it's very hard to find a judge who will rule in terms of the more favorable pro-immigrant rulings. But if you go to other parts of Texas, and this particular lawsuit was filed in Austin, you actually are more likely to get a judge who, at least you have a larger percentage chance of a judge who is more likely to have a disposition that could at least be welcoming of argument. And so that's what they did. They went to Austin and they found such a judge.
Texas stringing the razor wire along the border.
Right. Then there's two more cases. The razor wire along the border and the barriers in the water. And so for those cases, I mean, the federal government has at the moment the ability to cut the razor wire along the border if they want to. They have a favorable court ruling on that. But the question is, do they want to engage in what could actually be, you know, to describe it in a euphemism, a kinetic interaction with the forces that are down there in front of the razor wire, who are basically saying, go ahead and try this. And that's sort of a desire that no one has at the moment, I don't think. to create such a scene of basically mayhem in terms of the federal government cutting down wire that's meant to prevent people from coming in illegally. So it's all a mess. But I think both sides are sort of content, not content, but sort of are stuck where they are now, which is Texas, even though they lost, they're basically saying, go ahead, cut the wire, see what happens. And the federal government at least won the legal argument. But now the question is, do they feel the need to cut the wire down?
Why go to the Supreme Court if you're not going to cut the wire?
Correct. This is where it gets complicated.
I mean, it seems like they took this trip to the Supreme Court. They made this argument. They won.
Yep.
And now they're just saying, okay, we're going to step back.
Well, it's just hard. I mean, suppose you were the most anti, you know, border wire person in America. The question is, are you willing to be so anti-border wire that you would create a skirmish on the southern border that would be televised all over the media between federal and state officials where people are fighting about cutting out this wire?
Maybe you're right, Leon. It would show the Biden administration cutting down wire. I'm sure at this point they don't want that image out there.
Because, well, no, I'm just saying, it was one thing when you were desegregating the schools, and at least you were saying, okay, well, you know, we have to desegregate the schools, end of the story. But the problem is here you'd be cutting down the wire in service of allowing people to cross the border. It's sort of a no good deed goes unpunished situation.
Mm-hmm.
Here.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's just very difficult.
So that's it for the Texas cases, the current Texas cases. Is Abbott still busing people to northern cities?
Oh, yeah. That's still going on at a very, you know, very large clip, and I'm sure it'll go on even further as the spring happens and many, many more people start coming back through the border. And that's going to be a very difficult situation because at the moment there's a bit of a lull as the winter turns to spring, but when the spring comes, which is any minute now, those numbers are going to escalate, and it's very unclear what's going to happen in a lot of these cities.
Finally, Leon, my last immigration topic for today. The House of Representatives went through this whole thing. They tried it twice. They finally impeached Mayorkas.
Mm-hmm.
Is anything happening with that, or are we waiting till come back?
I think that the Senate thought that they would be able to dismiss this complaint in toto. Right up at the front. It's not clear that they have the votes to do that. And if they don't have the votes to do that, then they're going to have a trial. And if they want to have a trial on that thing, then at least the Republicans will be able to sort of grandstand on how poor the border is. They won't get one Democratic vote, so they won't have anywhere near the 67 they need to convict Mayorkas. But the point is, I think the end game is just to spend 2 or 3 days having a trial on the border and how porous it is.
Not really something I'd look forward to, but thanks so much, Leon. Immigration is going to be one of the top issues in the upcoming presidential election, and I appreciate your giving us this mini course on what's happening. That's Leon Fresco, a partner at Holland & Knight. And that's it for this edition of the Bloomberg Law Podcast. Remember, you can always get the latest legal news by subscribing and listening to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and at Bloomberg.com/podcast/law. I'm June Grosso, and this is Bloomberg. Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for The Future Investor, Data-Powered Transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/futureinvestor/radio.